kind of learned that the video version wasn't necessarily, you know, kind of worth it. And, you know, it's better that we should all not worry about whether we put on makeup today. So again, we're looking at Parshat Noach. We're looking at a couple texts from the Hasidim. We're looking at texts that specifically all of them deal pretty much with the concept of kind of being maniacal and being intense. And they're going to do it off of this, really off one verse. I will also warn you, if we have enough time, which we probably won't, I threw in a bonus text. I thought that like three texts wasn't going to be enough. So I started to work on a fourth text. The fourth text is a hot mess of a doozy. It is a Hasidic commentary on the Zohar and the chief book of mystical wisdom in Judaism. And the quote in the Zohar is so weird, and I went and tracked it down, and it only got weirder. The commentary only got weirder. And at the end, I'm not really amazed or blown away by what it ends with. The other thing is Rabbi Jeremy Marquis told me that he has a meeting at 1:30, which means that we all get kicked off at 1:30. So that's the way it goes in the modern synagogue world. All right, question. You guys all see the screen in front of you. So the pasuk, I didn't write this down. I'll have to do it later. Is Genesis 7 verse 1. Vayomer Adonai la Noach, bo ata v'kol beitecha el hateva, ki otcha ra'iti tzadik lifnei bador hazeh. Then the Lord said to Noah, go into the ark with all your household, for you, parenthesis alone is what the translation gave. I don't think that that word actually is there. Have I found righteous before me in this generation? So a classic kind of rabbinic question here is there's some extra words that maybe we didn't really need, right? First of all, the commentators are going to be interested in go into the ark, comma, and all your household, right? Like we're already told that Noah has a wife and kids, and we're already told earlier in this section of Torah that he is to go with his wife and kids and build an ark. So being told again, remember to take the whole family with you into the ark, is an interesting and specific mention. The other piece that they're going to be very interested in is the fact that the word righteous appears for a second time. So the Torah portion of Noach opens with the opening words. The opening line in the Torah portion is, and there was a man named Noah, and he was righteous in his generation. So we already knew that Noah was righteous. So for God to specifically say, for you alone have I found righteous before me in this generation, is interesting. The other thing is, and it's worth noting, even though I don't think our commentators are interested in it, the translation uses the word alone. The word alone, as I mentioned, does not appear in the text. Vayomer Adonai la Noach, bo ata lekol beitecha. And God said to Noah, take your whole family into the ark. Doesn't say you alone. Ki otcha ra'iti tzadik. For you, I see as righteous. Doesn't say you alone, but it's interesting to know. So we got three interesting commentaries. The first guy up is the Baal Shem Tov himself. So usually when we get a good commentary of the Baal Shem Tov, it's worth stopping on. And this one's quite a doozy because it's going to do what we often talk about in Hasidus, spin in a very different direction than the literal, right? We're almost in Hasidut never interested in that guy who got on that boat with all those smelly animals. Occasionally, the broad story is interesting to us, but not really here. So the Baal Shem Tov, the first, the OG of Hasidut, the original gangsta, the progenitor of the entire Hasidic school of thought, says this, Ark, Te'eva, which is spelled Taf, Yud, Vet, He, can also mean word. So Milah is the Hebrew word he put here. This is an allusion that a person must enter into every word of the Torah and the prayer with all one's strength and with all of the 248 bones and sinews and extremities, quote, with all your household, in complete misirut nefesh. And I translated that as soul sacrifice. So what is this move that he makes? How did he jump from you got to be intense And how does he get that out of, you know, hey, Noah, get in the ark, right? Like, that's a big leap. So the first move that he does there is to say the word teva, right, ark, can also mean a word. So in modern Hebrew, for those of you who know a little bit of modern Hebrew, when you have an acronym, right, FBI, NASA, the Hebrew word for that is roshe tevot, right? Another word for another way that teva is understood is a teva is a box. So somehow those two things mean the same thing. An ark is also a word. So when the text says at the beginning, bo ata v'kol beitecha el hateva, right? Enter into the ark. He could read it. The Besht is reading this alternatively as enter into the word. And then he continues by saying, enter into the word, el hateva, ki otcha ra'iti tzadik. Go into the word, for you I have found righteous, right? So he's kind of punning here, right? And the pun is enter into the word with righteousness, right? Enter into the word with extreme care, intensity, and devotion. Because for the Baal Shem Tov, a tzaddik is a person who's truly devoted to God, right? A person who's truly devoted to doing the right thing. And, of course, in Chassidus, we're very deeply believing that the person who is truly righteous is a person who's extremely cautious with language. The rabbis of the Talmud, the rabbis of Chassidus, very much believe that language is creation. Language is how we express our truest nature. So when we say things, we shouldn't say things carelessly. When we say things, we should say things that are holy and sacred and thoughtful. We should not say ugly, awful, angry words. We should enter into them. And more so than that, we should be really cautious about the language that we use and how thoughtful it is. He adds that this applies to every word of Torah, which he either applies literally as when you're studying text, you should really kind of dive in carefully and thoughtfully and with intensity and devotion. And with tefillah, with prayer, that you should be very cautious in your prayer, that it should be intense, and it should be really, like, you should take each and every word very seriously. There are stories of the Baal Shem Tov and the Hasidim that his prayers in the morning would take hours and hours and hours. You know, the same prayers that I knock out in about 20 minutes, he would spend 4 hours on, because he was so fixated, right? So autistically devoted, to go back to the conversation we started with, on each and every word and its intensity and its meaning, right? To that end, you know, it all sounded like Baruch, Atah, Adonai, right? And he was just deeply focused on the meaning of each and every word and contemplating what each and every word meant with all his strength. And then he throws in this funky thing with the 248 bones and sinews and extremities. So there's this classic Talmudic move that there are 248 bones and sinews, and there are 365 days of the year. If you take 248 and 365 and add them together, what number do you get? 613. That the commandments are an allusion to the bones and the sinews and the muscles of the body and the days. So what does he do? What does this Talmudic read do for us? It says when a person devotes their entire soul, their entire self, their entire physical nature to God each and every day of the year, that is the true fulfillment of all 613 commandments. It's a neat little move. It's a fun little mathematical pun. And here he's using that phrase, v'kol beitecha, your whole household, as the reference. He's basically saying, like, that word is not there superfluously. It alludes to the fact that you're going in with your whole house. We've, by the way, seen this before. We've seen that the word house has been used kind of homiletically and kind of as a broad category idea, as opposed to a literal, you know, your household. And then he finishes with a couple words that I think are fascinating. because I had to look it up because I thought it was odd. He finishes with a phrase in the Hebrew up here. He says, "Bemisirut nefesh." And Mesirut Nefesh is a very specific term. Mesirut Nefesh, if you read it in medieval commentaries, in Talmudic commentaries, even going back to the Torah, I believe, in Tanakh, the phrase may appear, is devotion of your soul. But it specifically means usually what's called Al Kiddush Hashem, in the sanctification of God's name, which is also a euphemism for martyrdom. Right? So Mesirut Nefesh is a concept that a Jew who sacrifices their life on behalf of God is doing the highest of mitzvot. The Baal Shem Tov does not mean that. And I know because I went and I looked, I thought it didn't fit here, right? There's no implication that you should enter into a word with all of your might and all your soul, and you should literally physically sacrifice yourself and die in, you know, the intensity of studying a word. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So I was like, let me look this up. And I looked it up, and behold, I found a citation in a book by Martin Buber to another place where the Baal Shem Tov uses the phrase Mesirut Nefesh. And the other place where he uses the term Mesirut Nefesh, it means kind of soul sacrifice. Like, it means intensity and dedication of your whole neshama, your whole nefesh, your whole soul. It doesn't imply death, right? There he didn't imply that you should die for it. Here he doesn't imply you should die for it. I'm sure I could go through a spin of all of the Baal Shem Tov's references to Mesirut Nefesh and find that he doesn't mean that. But, you know, Chaval al Azman, I don't have all the days to do that. So, great. Philip also threw in there the fact that Santana has a song called Soul Sacrifice. So we have all learned something new today about Santana. Okay, how do I get that off of the screen is the million-dollar question now. I could click the – I'm going to have to stop share and then go back to share again, I think, to fix that. Sorry about that, guys. It's not your fault, Phil. It's Zoom's fault. It's Zoom's fault. Okay. So someone else mentioned I think it was Audrey, said, hey, in the Torah, the phrase teva is taf va vet hey, but in the commentary that the Baal Shem Tov uses, he throws a yud in there. That's one of two things, Audrey. One is that a lot of the Hasidim didn't have a lot of access to the text, or they quoted Torah from memory, and therefore they may not be precise with exactly how a word is spelled. The other possibility is that the Baal Shem Tov was doing what's called Ketiv Maleh. And Ketiv Maleh is a practice in Hebrew going back a very long time, where if you throw a yud or a vav into a Hebrew word that does not normally have that yud or that vav, in order to indicate where the vowel would be, that is considered not misspelling, but what's called kativ maleh, which is like filling out the language to give training wheels to the reader. In fact, a lot of Hebrew words over hundreds of years evolved to the point that they're always written kativ maleh, that a yud kind of infiltrated the Hebrew and became a permanent fixture in a word. English has the same thing. I'm not a scholar in this, but there are words that if you read in, for instance, the writings of Thomas Jefferson or Alexander Hamilton, they spell a whole bunch of words differently than we do. They may spell them strangely or in a Middle English kind of way or more phonetically than we do today, and we dropped that phonetic spelling. So that's what Kativ Maleh is. And you've all learned something about Hebrew grammar. By the way, this might be the first, last, and only time I ever teach anything about Hebrew grammar. It was not the subject I did well in rabbinical school. I did really poorly on my grammar tests. You know, which strangely enough has not massively affected my ability as a rabbi. All right, our next text up is from a guy we've seen before, interestingly enough. And I'll remind those of us who haven't seen this acronym, this Roshei Tevot, at the beginning of it before. He's going to comment on the same verse, so don't worry, we're still stuck in the same verse. So the Admor Rabbi Moshe of Kobrin. So Admor is an acronym for Adonenu Morenu Verabenu, right? Our master, our teacher, our scholar, or our rabbi, Rabbi Moshe of Kobrin. I often refer to Rabbi Adelson in such a way, seeing as he is the senior rabbi of conservative rabbis in the community, at least until you drive to the South Hills, and then you got to go to the Rabbis Greenberg. If one speaks a word, what? It alludes to the complete devotion of the 248 sinews. Absolutely, all of their innermost essence and existence. Okay, so I didn't translate that super well. I kind of translated it very literally without trying to smooth it out too much. He has this word ma in there, and I don't really know what to do with it, so I just kind of left it there as what. But what he's getting at is this. Rabbi Moshe of Kobrin took the words of the Baal Shem Tov. He takes that quote we already learned about kind of coming with intensity and devotion to your study of Torah and your prayer, and he kind of takes it out a little bit more to talk about if one speaks a word. He says literally, Vayomer Davar, and Davar Ma, right? A word of what? And I don't know exactly what he's getting at there. I don't know why the word what shows up there. It may be a grammatical usage that I'm just not familiar with or has fallen out of common speech. But when you speak, another way of saying this is when you speak, one should allude in their speech to the complete devotion of the 248 sinews with all of your innermost essence and existence. So he uses two Hasidic phrases, pnimiut and yeshut. And they're beautiful words that I just wanted to teach a little bit about. Your panimiut is, your panim is your face. But to go lifnim is to go kind of inside, is the innermost, right? And your panimiut is your like innermostness would be a good translation of panimiut. So in Hasidic thought, they often talk about a nekudah ha-panimiut. The innermost point of a person, right? Like the core essence of your truth, like the centralness of your being. And it also juxtaposes nicely with existential philosophy, the concepts of essence and existence. They existed, no pun intended, parallel to these kind of ideas of psychology, psychotherapy, id, ego, superego, and also existential philosophy, which kind of emerges in the 17, 18, 1900s as a school of thought. The Hasidim were alongside of all of that stuff, and it would be hard to say that they were not affected by it. And then the word existence, that as I translated is in Hebrew, is yeshut, which is from the Hebrew word yesh. Yesh is just a really old school Hebrew construction for there is. The opposite of yesh is ein. There is not, right? Everything is yesh or it is ein. It is in existence or it is not in existence. So yeshut is this adjectival kind of, or sorry, nounification of a verb. And the verb is to be, right? Being. So being is yeshut. Existence is yeshut. So anyhow, sorry, long-winded grammatical play there, okay? Rabbi Moshe of Kobrin, they came to him and said, Rabbi, they asked of him, how does a great person enter and concentrate oneself into a small space? So this is where this text gets really sweet. Teva can be ark or box or word. So they're doing another pun, which is, so remember, the text started out by saying, go into the teva, right? It's telling Noach, God said, go into the ark, go into the teva. But it can also mean go into a word. The Hasidim are going to pun on this, right? And they're going to ask a couple things. One, teva can mean box, right? So what does it mean to enter oneself into a box? The implication by the Hasidim here being it's a small box, right? You're moving into a small space. Another way of saying this is, could be very literal, like how could a great person enter into a smelly ark full of animals? And a last place is to say that a word is very small, right? A word can be a tiny little thing. How does a person of great stature enter into a very small thing like a word or into a small space, right? And he has this amazing response, which either you'll say is somewhat self-evident, because I know Marilyn has talked before about kind of humility versus false humility, but that's a thing that the Hasidim do. He says, Rabbi Moshe of Kobrin answers, a person who is incapable of self-contraction and folding inward on account of their pride and greatness is a very small person indeed, right? So the ability to contract yourself and become smaller, right? To say, like, for the biggest, most important person in the world to walk into a space and contract themselves and just be dialed back. And like, humble's a good word here, but it's also not like, just be kind of like normal, be present, you know, is a really remarkable thing. I guess I've witnessed this like once in my entire life. I met the president of the United States once in my life, which was really cool. I have a picture of it up here. I'll get it. Show and tell with Rabbi Goodman. It's not the best example, but it's the closest one I can think of. So it'll be hard to find both the president and me. Of course, there's a reflection because it's a screen. I have to tilt it. Maybe I tilt it down. I don't know. All right. Tilted this way is the best way. Okay. So in the middle of the picture is a basketball team, right? In the middle of the picture is the president of the United States, Bill Clinton, in the way back, poking his head up over here is your friend, Rabbi Goodman. Full head of hair at the age of 19. I had a lot of hair. So the quick story about that is when I was in college, I was an assistant manager for the basketball team for George Washington University. And we played the number one team in the country, UMass. And since we were just down the street and since it's the number one team in the country, I walk into the Smith Center that day and there's, you know, metal detectors everywhere. I'm like, we've never had metal detectors at the game. And I started to think, like, maybe someone important is coming to the game. But I didn't know who, and they didn't say. And as the game kicked off, President Clinton and Chelsea Clinton took a seat in, like, a box over the court. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. So flash forward to the end of the game. We're up by 3 points. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, this is really cool. The president's here, and we're about to beat the number one team in the country in a huge upset. I should get into the locker room because there's a chance the president might be there. So I found a way to get myself into the locker room, started pouring cups of water for everybody, and I'm hanging out in the back of the room, and suddenly a Secret Service guy comes into the room, and he puts his finger in his ear, and he goes, nobody move. We're like, oh, okay. So we all freeze, and then, you know, Bill Clinton walks into this tiny, you know, locker room right afterwards, and he walks up to the coach, he shakes his hand, and says, congratulations, you didn't choke, which had us all laughing. You know, it was like broke the ice really nicely. And I think the thing that I liked about that, that was about a great man coming into a small space. First of all, the locker room was literally really small. But secondly, he didn't have to do that. You know, he totally could have just been like, oh, we watched a good basketball game. That was fun. But he knew that it was a big deal for the president to go and meet the team that upset the number one team in the country, and it would add to the day, right? Those players, you know, most of them never had professional careers. Most of them went on to, like, you know, be high school basketball coaches or, you know, kinesiologists or physical therapists or whatever. And this was basically the biggest day of their lives. And to have the president there for it, it made the moment bigger. But he kind of went in with a joke and he kind of shook hands and took a picture and was like real down to earth and real chill. And, you know, he didn't put on airs or like try and give a big like rousing speech or steal the moment for everybody. He just kind of walked in and he did his thing. And he was just appreciative that he could see a good basketball game and said thanks and took off. And it was kind of cool. So but a person who can't kind of dial themselves back into a space like that is a very small person indeed. One last thing on this text, which I think is kind of cool, just the words. Again, I'm doing a little bit with the Hebrew. I would highlight it, but this is a screenshot. So he uses the word, he says, Adam she'eno yechol lehitz tam tzem. And that's the Hebrew word tzimtzum, which is just the word to contract. But when you put it, it says lehitz tam tzem. When you put it into that grammatical declination into that what's called verbal structure. It becomes what's called hitpael, which makes it reflexive and personal. So it is a word that doesn't really exist in English, which is tzamtzem is to contract, lehitztamtzem is to self-contract, which as far as I know is not a thing, right? It's not a word, but they made it a word, which is kind of cool. And then there's another word that follows that, which is lehitzkapel, another word that I did not know. To be kaful is to fold, right? You fold a sheet, right? To lehitzkapel is, again, it's reflexive. It's to fold oneself. And again, it's a word that doesn't really exist in English. It doesn't really translate neatly either. There's not an easy way to say that one folds oneself. But this is to kind of double oneself over, to kind of bend over backwards might be a good translation of this. That to kind of like make yourself smaller. And I think it's an interesting text to kind of reflect upon. I'll give you guys a moment to kind of reflect upon this before we move on to the third text. But like, what does it mean to make yourself smaller as an act of intensity and devotion? What does it mean to be a big person or to be an important person, but to walk into a space and dial yourself back a little bit and say like, I'm gonna kind of be a little bit smaller. I'm gonna say like, this is not necessarily my moment to dominate. The intensity of my being is in finding a way to be present in a way that is not dominant over everybody else. It's a fascinating kind of move. I really love it. Go ahead, Marilyn.
As I'm listening to you, I'm thinking that that a word that for me works in that context is the word empathy. Because when you're too full of yourself, okay, you cannot empathize with the other. But if you're able to empathize with the other, you're minimizing yourself because you're seeing yourself as equal or even lesser. And so again, this goes back to the thing I said in the beginning is that you if you are only aware of yourself and your devotion, you're obsessive. If you forget what it is you're feeling devotion toward, then that's an obsession because you've lost sight of that which is worth your devotion. And I think the same thing is true with making one small. You lose sight of what is important, and that is that small box or that other person or that circumstance that isn't precisely about you anymore. It's about somebody else, and you can either enrich that or you can throw your dominance over it, which is the kind of obsession that worries me.
Right. It's really well said that like for a person who's like truly, you know, intense, they understand where it's about those limits. It's about the difference, but intensity is maybe dialing it back so that you kind of parenthetically say it. Renee, I see you. I'm just going to say something that Tanya said first because it's brilliant. Tanya pointed out a thing that I have made the connection in the past, but I hadn't made the connection in terms of how it might be understood with this week's reading and the text. So the word teva means arc, and we are playing with it because the Hasidim are interested in the word teva meaning word. But the word teva appears one other place in the Torah and one other place in Jewish tradition in addition. The other place it appears in Torah, many of you know, some of you may not, is that Moses, in the first chapter of Exodus, is placed in a teva, right? It's the basket that Moses floats in on the Nile is not literally translated as basket. It's literally written as ark. So that's strange, right? There's a lot of things that you could do to play on that we're not going to do. The other thing that Tanya brought up that is neat, because it has this spiritual dimension of kind of limiting, of intensity, of constricting, is we generally refer to as the box that the Torah is contained in as a teva. Sometimes we usually use the more common Hebrew that it's an aron. And aron is a funny one because aron is also a box, but it really means closet, but it can also mean a coffin. So the Torah is in a word that means, yeah, Audrey's like, oh no, yes, I know. But anyway, so it's kind of fascinating that all these words kind of are used. All right, Renee, go ahead.
Going back to Marilyn's word, empathy. I had always learned that empathy was something that you could feel for someone because you've gone through it yourself. And can you qualify that? Empathy versus sympathy, but I'm not sure how empathy enters into that.
No, it's beautiful to kind of, I mean, I think you're doing something that's another level above what I'm saying, which is you're trying to emotionally actualize what the Hasidic teaching is, which is to say a person who is intense and passionate doesn't mean that they dominate the space, right? I think, lahavdil, as we say, when I was in rabbinical school, I was applying to rabbinical school and I tried to get into, I had an interview and it went really badly. I've probably told this story before, but I won't tell the whole story again. But the rectification of my not very good interview was, we'd like you to do some Torah study for a couple months and then come back and interview again. And the only class that was available that was a Parsha class, what they wanted me to do was, strangely enough, with conservative radio commentator Dennis Prager, who is an observant, knowledgeable Jew who was teaching a Torah class. And by the way, at the time, this is 20 years ago, he was not as conservative as he is now. He was kind of a moderate Republican back then. But he was known as a guy who had a good Torah reputation because he'd worked with Joseph Telushkin on a Jewish book. And so I went to his Parsha class. And I'm going to insult him a little bit, and I hope that that's okay. This is my personal opinion of the class. It has nothing to do with who he is as an individual, as a television personality. But one of the things that was interesting about Dennis Prager was he could not dial himself back in the class. He was very kind of he didn't really listen to anybody else. You know, 40 people took this class and nobody ever got a word in edgewise. And I don't know if that has to do with the concept of sympathy or empathy, but it was to the point that I was kind of to take what Marilyn said and Renee said nicely together is he wasn't really listening. And so he was passionate about his material. No one could argue that. And he was intense about his material. No one could argue that. But his intensity was not the kind of intensity that Isaac of Kobrin advises us to have, which is he could not make himself small and dial himself back. And that meant, to your point, Renee, he could not enter empathy into the conversation. There was no ability for him to kind of make it smaller and make it personal and create space for other people, which is fascinating. And, you know, that's just how it was. I learned a lot of Torah, but, I mean, someone else in the class once said to me, I think this class is about 20% Torah and 80% Prager. And I was like, yeah, I think you're right. You know, he would kind of go off and pontificate. You know, I suppose I'm at my worst as a teacher when I do that. I try to almost never do that. You know, I want to stay rooted in the Hasidut. Sometimes I'm going off because I'm trying to really exemplify what they're talking about in a modern contemporary way. You know, I don't think I brought my story up about being the towel boy in the locker room when President Clinton walked in to glorify myself. I literally was handing out towels, guys. Literally handing out towels. Okay. Okay. We are on to, and if anyone else has a comment, we have enough time for the third of the four. Phil, go ahead.
My local Chabad rabbi, who's, you know, younger than me, good guy, when he speaks, when he speaks to a small congregation, if he's talking about the, the masters, Baal Shem Tov, you know, the Alter Rebbe, the Rebbe, any of those guys, or even the guys in the Talmud, whenever he's quoting somebody, he very often will say something along the lines of, you know, when you're a person like this, not like you and me, but when you're a scholar like one of these guys. And, you know, he is a scholar. Like, his knowledge dwarfs any of the people he's talking to in terms of Torah. But he just makes that conscious choice because he knows it'll hit home better if he relates to the people he's talking to. So he puts himself with them instead. you know, says, you know, like you and me, like as if we're equal Torah scholars, referring to these big giants. That's just what it made me think of.
It's a brilliant parallel. I think I may have said this in this class before, but it's a good historical lesson. There's kind of two schools of thought in the Hasidic world. Speaks to the larger point that I've made before. One is kind of talking about madrigot, that the you elevate in spiritual level by more intense study, more intense prayer, and the concept being that the great Hasidic rabbis are on a spiritual level that none of us can attain, right? That none of us can reach. And there are times when I feel that, right? Like when I hear about the Chabad, the Rebbe, you know, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, and the work that he did from 1975 to 1987 of surreptitiously and secretly going into the former Soviet Union to minister to the Jews there, I do think to myself, like, I'm not on that spiritual madriga. His grandfather by... his wife's grandfather, I believe, the Friedeker Rebbe. It's a famous story about him where in the 30s, the NKVD went into his house to interrogate him and to intimidate him and to get him to stop teaching Torah. And they said, you need to stop with the religion stuff because this is the Soviet Union and we don't believe in that anymore. And you teaching Torah is... bad. And he says, I'm a rabbi, I teach Torah. And they said, no, you don't understand. And they put a gun on the table. And they said, we need you to stop teaching Torah. And the Friedeker Rebbe famously said, this kind of tactic may scare a person with only one life and only one world, but I am a person who has many lives and two worlds. So your intimidation is only serving to give me the belief that I am going to ascend to the world to come. So I am with you, Phil, in the sense that, like, I don't know that, like, putting me down, putting us down, saying we're not on that spiritual level is resonant with me. And by the way, Simcha Bunim and the Kotzker Rebbe and Levi Yitzhak Berdichev were all on your wavelength, we're all on my wavelength, and which is to say, Torah is accessible to all, madrigot don't really exist, we're all at the highest spiritual level if we want to be at any given moment, or as I like to say more contemporarily, Chassidut is for the people, Wu-Tang is for the children. But the final thought there is, like, we all kind of aspire to be at the level of the Friedeker Rebbe, who could say, and I don't know that I could say this, when two Gestapo guys walk into your room and put a gun on the table and say, we're going to kill you for teaching Torah, to say, I'm not afraid. This is what I do for a living. You know, that's a pretty high spiritual madriga. So that kind of, like, modesty is important. False modesty is not good. Being on the same level as everybody else is important. Acknowledging that, like, being of a high spiritual caliber is also worthy of note. I'm full of really funky stories today. I don't know what's up with that. Any other comments before we do the last text? The last text probably isn't as good as that one, so, but that text is really, really good. I can't help the order that things appear in our Hasidic text. All right, our final text for today is from the Chose of Lublin. So he's, you know, chronologically speaking, earlier again than the last guy we looked at. He was a contemporary of the Maggid of Mezrich. And the Maggid of Mezrich, so the Baal Shem Tov didn't write anything himself. His followers and the Maggid of Mezrich were really the kind of popularizers of his message. So the Maggid was the teacher of the Chose of Lublin, the seer of Lublin, who was believed to have prophetic powers. The texts that we study of him from the book that I bring you guys are almost never kind of like mystical and prophetic. They're way more like Torah-itic and straight and down to earth. So he said this, "For you have I found righteous." The Chose of Lublin would say, "If I will hear from a person, I hear that you are a tzaddik. I do not believe them, for there is not one good man on earth." And the good man there is tzaddik. Ein tzaddik ba'adama. And that's a verse from Ecclesiastes. So if the Chose of Lublin, if people come, we hear your, I got a phone call, I don't know why. we hear you're a righteous person. He would go, nah, I'm not. So this kind of concept of entering in with humility is really important. And then it keeps going. And if a miracle were to take place, and the Holy One, blessed be, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, in God's self, that as God did to Noah, right? Noah says, I have found you righteous, for you are righteous. I would only believe God in that very instant that I heard those words, for there is not a person on earth, even a completely righteous and truly great individual, that their certitude of what they will do in the next moment and what will be of their goodness and their inclination. All right, so what just happened there? So the Chosei of Lublin is kind of continuing on this thread that we talked about of modesty. Modesty, but with intensity. Because the front end of the verse says, go into the ark. And then the back end of the verse says, because you are the only righteous person, right? And the Chosei of Lublin's like mind is blown. He's like, wow, what would it be like if God's self came down, looked me in the eye and said, listen, there's 6 billion people on planet Earth. Literally all of them are hot garbage on a stick except you. You are the only truly righteous individual on planet Earth. If God's self told you that, how would you, Renee, how would you, Dee, how would you, Audrey, how would you, Rich, feel about that moment, right? God's self comes down and says, you are the most righteous human being on the planet, right? What would that moment feel like? And the Chosei of Lublin basically says, I wouldn't let it go to my head. It's a brilliant thing. He says, I wouldn't let it go to my head. I would say to myself, okay, I'm righteous right here, right now. In this second, in this Berega Echad, on this moment, I am righteous. 20 minutes ago, maybe not so much. 20 minutes from now, maybe not so much. And so I think that that's an amazing teaching on, to maybe to Phil's point also, of like what it means to be truly kind of like modest. That God's self could come down and say, you are righteous. And your response would be, all right, like I'm righteous right now. I'm not going to let it go to my head. I'm going to keep going with the same devotion and intensity and focus on being a good person that I had at the moment that God told me I was righteous. Because the minute that I get the belief, like, you know, God comes down to Moses and says, you are the leader of the Jewish people, right? We know that Moses was Ish Anav, that he was a humble individual. That if you let it go to your head and you stop being, you know, you start to say like, huh, God gave me the tap, right? God told me I'm righteous. So I can be a total jerk the rest of my life because God proved that, like, I'm not really being a jerk because I'm actually righteous, right? It doesn't work. So the Chosei of Lublin is basically saying, like, the only truly righteous person is, to quote 90s hip hop, chiggity check yourself before you wreck yourself, right? You need to kind of constantly be reflecting on whether you are actually a righteous person. Nobody is naturally righteous. It comes with a required intensity and devotion. To take it back one text, we're thinking of the fact that a person might want to be very reflective of their speech and very sensitive of the things that they say. Another way, if we go back one more text to take the Chosei of Lublin's words to what the Besht said, is that you might say, I might say to myself, I'm such a great rabbi. You know, I study Torah with such an incredible focus. The words that I say are so brilliant, right? I'm only as good as the last thing I said, and I'm only as good as the current bit of Torah that I'm learning, right? If I stop and say, like, I don't need to learn any more Torah, I learned enough, or I don't need to focus as hard on the next words because I've learned them before, right? We're back on Noach again. I did all this stuff last year, right? I'm good. The minute you let down your guard, you stop being good, right? Another way of saying this in kind of the parlance of our time is, you know, the thing that makes a person great is the continued aspiration to continue to be great, right? Michael Jordan, doesn't roll out of bed to be Michael Jordan. He goes to practice every day and he works really hard, right? To be excellent at the law, I don't think Ruth Bader Ginsburg slacked. I don't think she said, like, I don't need to read any more legal briefs. I know the law backwards and forwards. The law comes from my mouth, not the other way around, right? She kept working and learning and writing and thinking. You know, she never stopped. And you know, the minute you get complacent is the minute you lose that intensity. And that's a good place to finish for the day. Also, because we're going to get kicked off in 2 minutes. But thanks, you guys, all for joining us today. I really appreciate you all. Carry forth for the rest of the week, even in this strange Zoom environment, even in this strange kind of semi-quarantini world with the intensity. Go ahead, Renee.